We're marking the end of the First World War today. Its impacts were enormous here in Australia and throughout Europe. And in France, where so many battles were fought, there were particular battles in Champagne, where the city of Rheims was bombed almost to oblivion. Its rebuilding has made it a city of interest for those who care for the architecture of the 1920s. But today, Rita Ehrlich interviews the author of a novel that is set entirely during the First World War in Champagne. The novel is called The Champagne War, and its author is Fiona McIntosh.
Fiona, you've written lots and lots of books. You've written 39 books in total, but this latest one, The Champagne War, is a particularly poignant book, I think. It's a love story set during the First World War, and it's a very poignant account both of love and of the vines and of the wines made during that difficult time. What got you interested in it?
Well, what a big question. What got me interested in it? I love France, and we do go there several times for books research, and I always try and do one trip away from the research that might trigger an idea. And this is what happened. I was in Paris researching a separate title and decided to do a day trip into the Champagne region in the Northeast. And I had visited there before many years ago. And so I knew what to expect, but just to see all that beauty again, it was absolutely delicious. And we went to the city that, you know, that we call Reims, but the French call Rheims, and to visit the cathedral. And I was astonished to walk down there, the nave, and discover that there was this amazing gallery of photographs from World War One. And I had no idea how the city had been all but razed to the ground. I think it's something like 95 or 96% of the buildings no longer existed by the end of the war. And
yes, I was told by someone that of the entire city, there were only 22 buildings left undamaged after the First World War.
Now, I walked in silence and increasing horror to see what was done, and began to imagine how the women and children and the elderly coped. And I realized how they coped was very resilient. They went underground. They turned their lives upside down, and they began this subterranean way of living for the duration of the war. And all of this just triggered in my imagination that there was a story here just yearning to be told. And I came back to Australia, and it was time to start talking about what might come next down the track, because each of my books take about 2 years to research. There's a lot of work in each book. And I was talking to my publisher, and I was saying, we could write about this or that. We were just tossing over what might be a good follow-on. And she, out of the blue, said, do you know what? I would love you to write about champagne, Fiona, because it's my favorite drink in the world. And I had just, you know, seen this amazing photographic exhibition. And I thought, it's meant to be. So I'm going to write this story. And so I returned to Epinay a few months later. And this time I'd never plot. So I didn't really have any idea for the story at this stage. I just knew it would be about a woman who is under the most enormous stress. And I wanted her to be a champenoise, because I was inspired by Madame Pommery and by Veuve Clicquot. I mean, I loved their stories. And I thought, I'm sure I can come up with a wonderful story based around these sort of powerful, brilliant, resilient, strong women who really created the champagne industry that we know today. They had so much influence over the champagne industry in the 19th century. Anyway, would you like me to tell you how I actually found my story?
Yes, I'd love to, because okay. I can imagine many, many stories, but this is a very particular story you've told.
Yes. My husband and I were walking along the Avenue de Champagne, and anyone who's been there will know it's very glamorous, full of ostentatious buildings, declaring that they are the most important champagne brand and we should notice them. Anyway, we were enjoying ourselves. It's a quite elegant boulevard and just walking down. And my husband, Ian, said to me, have you actually got a story, knowing full well that I never operate with any plot in mind? And I said, no. And he said, you always traumatize me when you do this because we're here and we're just ambling along. And I said, look, I just have to put myself in the way of a story. It's going to find me. And with that, we came across this very elegant, quiet, almost like a French manor house. It didn't look like any of the others in the street. It was much more French. It didn't scream anything, but really almost fairy tale. And I completely fell in love with it. And I said, you know, if I was going to live anywhere, this is the house I'd live in. It was the smallest and the cutest. And I said, it's utterly beautiful. And it had all those lovely witches hats and, you know, gabled windows.
Oh, yes, yes. I know the look of it.
It was
yes.
over five floors and it was just symmetrical and beautiful. Anyway, there was this, we were standing and admiring it, taking some photographs, and there was this team of tradies on the pavement, obviously preparing to do some work on this very house. And one of them broke away and came up to us, and I realized it was a woman, and she said, can I help you? And we said, we're sorry, we don't mean to impose, you know, we're travelers, we love this house. And she said, would you like to see inside? You know, no one ever has to ask me that twice.
Yes,
so
that's
I made
right.
a break for the door, you know, through the gates, and I was gone. Then I sort of got a hold of myself and said to her, you know, what about the owners? You know, I began to whisper. I said, is it okay? Is this being a little bit too forward? And she said, no, I am the owner. And so it was, and she was dressed in jeans and she had paint all over and her hair was all bundled up. She looked like one of the workers, you know, and she said, come on in, come on in. She immediately opened a bottle of champagne and poured champagne and she was chatting to us, tell me about yourselves. And so she learned that I was a writer and she thought this was splendid.
Yes, because the French have huge respect for writers.
Yes, oh, absolutely. And they love Australians too. And because they just can't imagine anyone lives so far away would come all the way to France. I mean, the French really struggle with the journey. And we don't see loads of French like we see maybe loads of Brits because they're just appalled by the long journey that has to be made. Anyway, she was chatting the more, and her name is Sophie Signol, and she's from House Gonnet. And the more Sophie chatted, the more I realized the story was coalescing around us. I mean, Ian was sitting somewhere very jolly, sipping champagne and couldn't have been happier. But the two of us girls were just chatting, and I learned that she's a widow, that she'd inherited from her father. She'd learned the craft of champagne making and the growing of vines at her father's knee. And the way she spoke about champagne, it was so romantic. I mean, I was completely mesmerized by this woman. And I finally said, Sophie, you are my story. You're the character I've been longing to meet. And you've just by accident tapped me on the shoulder and said, here I am. And she said, you're going to write about me. And I said, well, I'm going to base a character on you of, and you're going to, you know, time travel. I'm going to take you back 100 years. And she said, and I said, may I do this? May I sort of rummage around in your life and do this? And she said, so long as you give me an absolutely torrid romance, you may do what you like with me. And so that's why I had to make this quite a powerful love story, a sort of a bittersweet love story. But it's a love story not just between two people, but it's about Sophie and the love story she has with the vines, with the grapes especially, because they have personalities, the making of the champagne, her love of country, her love of life and other people and survival. So it's a real, you know, it's a love story on many levels, I felt. And anyway, the story was sort of complete from that moment.
How much research did you have to do about what the First World War did to the area?
Oh, indeed. You know, an undertaking like this demands years of research. And this book is the hardest book I've ever written. It's certainly the most research I've ever done because, as you rightfully point out, I had to learn about what the war was doing to the region and how it's profoundly affected the making of champagne, I had to understand where one of my characters, Charlie Nash, who's a captain in the British Army, where he would have been stationed, where his trench was, and that meant working with a war historian and topographical maps that I can't read, and him saying he would have been at this point, and then us walking over muddy fields around Rams to find this exact spot to say Charlie would have been right here, and understanding what the landscape would have looked like. Now, the Champagne region had just been blitzed by phylloxera. So they were emerging in the early 20th century from the enormous damage that had been done by this pest and the disease that had taken its time to find the champagne vines. There was so much to enjoy. The pest was gladly eating its way through.
Yes, that's right.
Burgundy just, and Bordeaux, yes. Everywhere it wanted to go. And the champagne makers thought, okay, so we're resistant. It's not happening to us. But no, it ravaged, and centuries old vines had to be burned, and dreadful, dreadful stuff. So they were emerging from this, and as they were just getting strong again and feeling, you know, all the vines were strengthening and would be proud again, along came the First World War, and it created this network of trenches through the vineyards, and just the artillery that blew up and devastated so many vineyards. And the people of the time, the women, and the children, went out into those fields because they still had to bring those grapes in, because the grapes didn't know there was a war. They were growing as best they could. And so at harvest time, not just harvest time, I mean, there's something to be doing in the vineyards all year round. So they were pruning, or they were tying up the vines, or they were giving them special air, or they were going through all the various stages. But under bombing, they brought the harvest in. So it was just a time of ravage and despair for them.
It was a terrible time, and they were, the in Reims anyway, they were protected by this huge network of underground cellars that the Romans, I think, had originally dug.
That's right. They were limestone chalk pits that the Romans had dug. But down the centuries, they had become a network of tunnels beneath the city, the cathedral city, and it was, you know, a perfect position to store champagne in this network of hundreds and hundreds of kilometres, with perfect temperature and perfect sort of atmosphere for this champagne to, particularly to do its second fermentation in the bottle. And it was safe for people to be, underground. Well, apart from getting rickets and things like that.
Yes, that did occur to me too. The lovely thing in the book too is a sense of discovery, your discovery of the flavours of champagne, as well as how it's made.
Yes, thank you. I will admit now to your readers that I am a teetotaler. But if I'm going to drink two drinks to celebrate with people, it will either be a glass of champagne, because who can resist that?
That's right.
Something sweeter and stickier as a dessert.
Rita Ehrlich was speaking with the author of The Champagne War, Fiona McIntosh.